Hello everyone, and thank you for joining me for this podcast all about forensic entomology. Now, entomology is the study of insects. Forensic entomology is the application of using those insects or arthropods in legal investigations. Now, before we get into this sort of deeper biology behind this relatively new science, what I want to do, as with most of my forensic-based podcasts, is to just talk about a real-life case study, just so that it can really give this recording a little bit more kind of context. So I want to take you back to the 24th of October 2007, because back then an article was published with quite a striking headline, and it said, 48 years later, bugs clear convicted murderer. Now that in itself, it just seems really peculiar. Bugs clear a convicted murderer. How can possibly creatures like insects be used to clear someone of something so heinous, a crime like murder? Well, it was all to do with a man who was convicted 48 years ago, and I'm talking 48 years prior to 2007, 48 years ago, of the rape and murder of a 12-year-old girl. And this man was finally exonerated. But it took a few hundred flies and the young science of forensic entomology to win his freedom. So this is the case of Stephen Truscott, who was only 14 years old at the time when he was sentenced to die in Canada by hanging for the murder of childhood friend Lynn Harper. Now, Truscott was the last person seen with Harper late in the afternoon of June 9th in 1958. She was a passenger on his bike on the outskirts of their Canadian village. Her body was found 2 days later near the place where the two had been seen. Now, his sentence stimulated debate over the death penalty, primarily because of his youth. And I've talked at great length about the science behind the death penalty in another podcast, if you are interested. So maybe after listening to this one, that's one worth checking out. And I talk about age as being one of the real key, I guess, hot topics or hot things to kind of debate when looking at the pros and cons of having something like the death penalty. But there I talk about it specifically in relation to the United States. So although the debate that happened here contributed to the abolition of capital punishment in Canada, Truscott still served 10 years in jail and has spent the rest of his life basically living in the shadow of this unwarranted conviction. Now, last month, as it was reported, so we're talking here September 2007, the court quashed the conviction, labelling it a miscarriage of justice. And again, just a quick note, I've recorded a separate podcast all about miscarriages of justice. So if you are interested in this case and ones like it, then do check that one out too. Now, the ruling wasn't a surprise to entomologist Richard Merritt of Michigan State University, one of a dozen renowned and certified forensic entomologists in the US, whose testimony in the trial was described as critical. The proof, Merritt argued, during a rigorous 7 hours testifying, was provided by the flies that would have landed on the young girl's body within minutes of her death. The pathologist who conducted the autopsy put the time of death between 7:15 and 7:45 p.m. But the entomological evidence indicated that the death occurred much later, probably the following day, at a time when Truscott was known to be somewhere else. So the court record contains several photographs and precise measurements of the insects that had colonised the body moments after death. Chief among them were the blowflies that had laid hundreds of eggs, beginning soon after they found the body. Now, the life cycle of the blowfly is well known, so it was possible for the scientists to work backwards from the time that the body was discovered to the time when the flies first colonised the body. They were able to ultimately determine how long it had been since colonisation had taken place. They did that by measuring the size of the larvae, or the maggots, in the early photographs. And they found that the maggots were not nearly as large as they would have been if they had been present on the body since the early evening of June 9th. Both testified that Lynn was most likely killed the next morning, not during the narrow window the night before, when it was possible that Truscott could have been the killer. A fascinating case study, a very sad and tragic tale. The girl lost her life, and essentially Truscott, to some extent, kind of lost a big portion of his with this kind of looming over him. But it's incredible that we're able to use our knowledge of insects and the life cycle of insects to be able to quash that conviction. So let's talk about forensic entomology in a bit more detail. Well, as a science, it's typically subgrouped into three kind of large main areas: urban, stored product, and medical legal. When we talk about urban forensic entomology, we're talking there about things like pest infestations in buildings or gardens that may be the basis of litigation or court cases between private parties and service providers. When we're talking about stored product, we talk about how it's used in litigation over infestation or contamination of commercially distributed foods by insects. But the focus of this podcast is the third group, the medico-legal category. It's used in litigation over criminal actions by people in cases such as murder or rape, suicide or physical abuse, for example. Now, I think before I get into the biology behind the insect life cycle and how it can be used, another fascinating story here. It's actually the history of forensic entomology and the first or the earliest recorded case of it being used. And it dates back to 1235 AD and a man named Sung Tzu, a Chinese death investigator who wrote The Washing Away of Wrongs. Now, in this book, the first forensic entomology case was recorded. So as the story goes, a murder by slashing occurred in a village, and the local death investigator was ordered to solve the crime. The investigator had all the villagers bring their sickles to one spot and lay them out before the crowd. Flies were attracted to one of the sickles, probably because of the invisible remnants of the tissue remaining on it. And according to the story, the owner broke down and confessed to the crime. So that's the first documented example where insects have been used, in essence, to solve a murder. So let's talk about insects in more detail. The word insect actually comes from the Latin insectus, meaning cut into sections, clearly referring to their segmented bodies. They're arthropods, the most diverse group of animals on Earth. It's thought that there's over 1 million species, and we categorise them mainly into two groups: the Apterygota, or the wingless insects, or the Pterygota, the winged insects. Now, really, the heart of this podcast, the crux of it, is all to do with the life cycle. And that's what I want to focus on for a moment, because we can't really talk about forensic entomology and how it can be applied without understanding the finer details of the life cycle of the insect and the phase of change, or ultimately what's known as metamorphosis, that takes place. Because from the egg, we get the larva or the maggot, then that develops into a pupa, and then the winged adult. So let's just put some numbers here, numbers to it here. So let's start with an egg. Let's imagine an insect lays an egg. Here we're talking about 1.2, 1.3 millimeter egg in total. Now, 12 hours later in this life cycle, we reach a phase called the first instar. And that egg that was 1.2 millimeters or so has now grown to 3 millimeters in length. Another 12 hours may pass, and we're at the second instar or phase of the life cycle. And this is now a 6 millimeter organism. 12 hours later, we're at the third instar, and we've grown to an incredible 17 millimetres. Now, maybe like a day or so later, about 24 hours later, we're at the pre-pupa phase. And we've shrunk down a little bit. We're now at 12 millimetres. Maybe give it another 2 days and we're at the pupa. And here we're about 9 millimetres. And then about 2 or 3 days after that, we have the adult. And that's somewhere in the region of 6 to 8 millimeters in size. Again, maybe another 12, 24 hours after that, might start laying more eggs. So in that life cycle, you can see that I've given very specific sizes and very specific times. So if we think back to what I said at the beginning of the podcast and the Truscott case, you can see that actually the strength of the evidence can be quite overwhelming when you can put such specific details to that. So when the scientists said that they were able to work out how long the insects had colonized the body for, you can see actually understanding the life cycle of the insect really allows you or affords you the opportunity to do something like that. Insects arrive at the scene in a very predictable series of progression. It's something called faunal succession, and that can be used to determine the time of death. Temperature, sun exposure, location of a body, as well as the surrounding environment, can all affect the timings. So let's just talk through some of these succession waves, if you like. So the first wave would be the flies, or specifically the blowflies. So here we're talking about maybe a corpse that is fresh. So in terms of the age of the corpse, we're talking probably the first 2 to 3 months. The second wave that then comes in would be the blowflies and the flesh flies. So there, the corpse would give off a sort of odour, and that would be our second wave in this faunal succession. At about 3 to 6 months, when the fats are rancid in the corpse, that's when we see this third wave of dermistid beetles. The fourth wave would include various other flies, and by the fifth wave, we're talking here about other beetles and other various flies, and that would be when the corpse has, I guess, we're talking maybe 4 to 8 months, aged about 4 to 8 months, and ammonia fermentation is occurring. Between 6 to 12 months, mites will have infested the body and that corpse. And after about a period of a year to 3 years, when that corpse has gone completely dry, then what we find is just dermistid beetles infesting that body, followed by just other types of beetles, maybe 3 and above years. So basically what we've got is this successional wave of insects. So I said at the beginning that the blowflies are the first to colonise. They're the first to arrive at the scene. They're a member of the Calopharidae family, quite metallic in appearance, really distinctive. If you've seen a picture, you might be able to imagine what one looks like, but if you haven't, and if you were to look on the internet at a picture of them, really quite distinctive. They've got this metallic bluey green, or sort of like bluey black colour to them. They're only about 10 to 12 millimetres in length, but they have this incredible ability to smell death, supposedly, from up to 10 miles away. Just picking another example of one of the waves. So the second wave, I said flesh flies would then come to the body. They're members of the Sarcophagidae family. I might have pronounced that slightly incorrectly. Apologies if I have there. These flies breed in what's called carrion, or decaying flesh, or dung, or decaying material. But some breed in open wounds of mammals. Now, these flies can arrive within minutes. They lay eggs that hatch to maggots, and then the maggots feed on the softer parts of the body, and more insects arrive to feed on the body and each other, and then you can see how this wave of insects just develops. Let's skip to the third wave and the dermistid beetles. Now, these are members of the Coleoptera family. Common names, you might know them by the larder beetle, or the hide beetle, or the carpet beetle, or carpa beetle even. So the dermistid beetles go, there's quite a number of common names for this particular insect. And in fact, actually, interesting fact, that some species of dermistid beetle can cause actually millions of pounds worth of damage to fibres that get infested with them. These have a life cycle of about 45 days, so quite quick in the grand scheme of things. Really interesting is the sixth wave. So when I talked through the faunal succession, I said the sixth wave included mites. Mites have existed for over 400 million years. It's quite incredible that we think now today that there's over 45,000 different species of mites. And again, a forensic entomologist would not only be able to identify that mites have colonised the body, but also would be able to identify the species of mite that has colonised the body. Now, as with any kind of criminal investigation, collection of evidence is critical, but none more so when there could be entomological evidence there. So there's lots of different things that you need to consider. So, for example, let's just imagine a scenario. We've got a body on a patch of land. Well, first of all, let's talk about the maggots. Well, maggots would concentrate in the head and open wounds first. So you would need to look at the corpse and ground interface. You would want to maybe collect about 2 dozen maggots and pupa. And you'd want to keep the maggots and the pupa separate. You'd want to keep hairy and smooth maggots separate, for example, and place all of them in a cooler or a fridge. You wouldn't want to freeze them. You'd need to label the specimen jar with location, the date and hour of collection, case number, sample number, detail, the collector, because evidence of this nature really, it really does come down to the finer detail. You'd want to preserve most of the maggots in about 70% ethyl or isopropyl alcohol solution. One thing that the forensic investigator absolutely needs to be aware of is that maggots crawl away to pupate. So you'd need to look under objects roughly about 3 to 10 meters. I mean, it seems quite far, but from the corpse for pupa. Fly pupa are seed-like. They're about 1 to 2 centimeters long and red to dark brown in colour. When it comes to the beetles, you need to collect beetles from on and underneath the corpse. In fact, you'd want a sample at least 10 centimetres deep from where a corpse may be found. You'd want to take 3 or 4 soil samples from underneath the corpse. Again, refrigerate, but be careful not to freeze. And you need it secure, maybe in a secure ventilated tin would be an ideal method of collection there. You'd want to take the temperature of the air and of the maggot mass found at the crime scene. You would want to use maybe something like a hand net to collect flying insects over the corpse. You could use a standard insect net here, or maybe make a small hand net from just kind of stiff wire and cut out kind of fibers. But a hand net would be something useful here when collecting evidence. You'd want to kill and preserve the adult flies in fluid, as with the maggots. But you would also need supporting data. So you'd want to look at the previous weather for the area, maybe the on-site weather data. So you're talking there recording about 5 to 7 days worth of information. You'd want photos and videos of the crime scene and records of the time of collection. Now, perhaps more so in this podcast than others I've done, into different forensic specialisms, the evidence collection aspect here is really crucial, because here the evidence isn't something like, I don't know, ripped clothing or a particular weapon necessarily. I mean, obviously we may be looking for those kind of things, but we're dealing with living organisms here, with insects, with arthropods. So it really does require specialist knowledge. Now, what I think is particularly fascinating is that there are things called body farms that exist that are actual research facilities where scientists study the decomposition of human remains in different types of settings. What they're trying to do is mimic decomposition of corpses in different settings and then analyse those findings just to really enhance our knowledge of insects, the life cycle of insects, and how all of, well, everything that I've spoken about in this podcast operates. But you can do this yourself. I mean, this is one, a little experiment that I do with my own students. You could take a simple cup, put a piece of meat in there, cover it with a thin layer, maybe about a centimetre or so of crushed leaves, and you just place your cup in maybe like a shaded area and just leave it for a week or so, and then come back and just see what kind of creatures you have. And you can play around with the settings. You can leave it maybe in a sunlit area. You can maybe put more leaves or less leaves. You can change the environmental kind of factors and the environmental gradient that you have. You could expose the meat, if you like, to other kind of chemicals and just see what happens. And ultimately, this is what the body farm does. These research facilities are ultimately just looking at decomposition of human remains and the things that affect them. Now, I started this podcast with a true case study, and I'd like to finish this podcast with another particularly famous case here, and that's that of Vincent Edward Brothers, born May the 31st, 1962. Brothers is an American mass murderer. He was convicted of killing his wife, their 3 children, and his mother-in-law. And what's incredible is that the key piece of evidence that linked him to the crime was a grasshopper, or particularly the leg of a grasshopper, the red shanked grasshopper. Its leg is, it's got this really distinctive reddish colour. According to the prosecution, Brothers was an admitted adulterer who never loved his family and used murder as a means to basically rid himself of the financial burden that they placed on him. They claimed that on July 2, 2003, he flew to Ohio to visit his brother in order to establish an alibi. Now, when he touched down in Ohio, he rented a Dodge Neon from a rental car shop. Now, detectives seized the rental car and they alleged that the records proved that while the car was in his possession, Brothers put more than 5,400 miles on the car. Now, he said that he never left the state, that he didn't go anywhere. But that's more than enough mileage for him to have driven to Bakersfield, where the murder took place, or murders took place rather, and back. The prosecutors contended that Brothers drove around 4,500 miles in 3 days. The radiator and the air filter was taken to the Bohart Museum of Entomology for testing. Now there, Professor Lynn Kimsey from the University of California took the stand and testified that she found several insect species in the car parts that were found only in the West, and that the types of insects found indicated that the car had only been driven at night. The prosecution also introduced video evidence that proved that Vincent's brother Melvin had used his credit card at a Walmart, and Melvin also admitted to forging his brother's signature, and that he had no knowledge of his brother's whereabouts between July 4th up to and including July the 7th. Evidence showed that a call was placed to Brother's cell phone in Ohio at around 4 o'clock on the day of the murder from another residence. So what we have there is a case where this red-shanked insect leg, among other particular, I think there are a couple of wasps as well, they were found within the car parts, and they're only found in one sort of region on the west of the US. And yet Brothers were saying that he never left the state that's on the far right. So we've got one critical piece of evidence proving ultimately that his car had travelled a distance that he claimed it hadn't. And that really was his downfall. So I started the podcast with a story about how Truscott was exonerated ultimately. And I wanted to finish with how we've basically used insects to catch the criminal. So it's quite incredible, fascinating stuff. And if you are interested to learn more, if you have any questions about anything that I've discussed in this podcast, do get in touch at kytosbology@gmail.com. There are other podcasts that I've referred to in this particular one, which if you are interested, I would wholly recommend. Science and the Death Penalty in the US, and one specifically on, as I mentioned before, miscarriages of justice. So if you are interested in cases like the ones I've talked about in today's podcast, then do give that a listen. Although it is rather shocking, some of the stories that I mention. But I go into detail there about other specialisms in forensics and how developments in those fields have been able to basically either catch the criminals, or the real criminals rather, and exonerate the truly innocent. And on that note, I'd like to say a big thank you to everybody for listening. Until next time.